All right. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And we are joined by Renfrey Clark. Renfrey Clark is a historian who's been the Green Left correspondent for Moscow throughout the 1990s and has written extensively on Ukraine's economy and politics and has also written a book on the history of Ukraine. We're having him on our program today to have a discussion about politics of Ukraine and how some of its historical context informs and contextualizes the events that are happening today, including the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. Hello, Renfrey.
Good to be with you.
Welcome, welcome. So I'll start off with a kind of broad question. So what can you tell us about some of the history of Ukraine, beginning from its formation as an independent state following the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991? And what are some of its characteristics, this new state of Ukraine?
Well, Ukraine at the end of the Soviet period was one of the most developed and technically advanced of the Soviet republics. It was the one that, in the opinion of a noted German bank, had the best chance of prosperity as an independent country after the breakup of the Soviet Union. Its history since then has been catastrophic. Today, Ukraine is the poorest of all the successor states to the Soviet Union. Gross domestic product per capita in Ukraine is now about the equivalent of Guatemala. So from being part of the developed world, it's become part of the underdeveloped world very much. Now, what went wrong? Well, Ukraine always did have certain problems in this respect, that its various regions had quite distinct histories and traditions. In the West, you had a tradition of closeness to Europe. It was part of the Soviet Union only for a few decades throughout history. In the East, it was extensively Russified. It had traditions of subjugation, first to the Russian imperial state, and after that, a long history as part of the Soviet Union. So they're quite different historical and political traditions in various parts of the country. As well, this is a country, something like Canada, in the respect that you don't have the same language spoken throughout the national territory. In Western Ukraine, the language is Ukrainian, which is close to Russian, but definitely a distinct language. About half the population, including the capital, Kiev, were traditionally speakers of Russian, and this was particularly notable in the eastern provinces of Ukraine. So strong differences between different regions. Now, it becomes independent, and you find those tensions within the country eventually coming to the fore. They're not immediately acute. But the critical thing in Ukraine during its post-Soviet history is the application by successive governments in Kiev of economic policies that were totally unsuited to the country and its situation, largely under the advice, if not dictation, of Western advisors. You have to remember that this had been part of the Soviet Union. It had an economy that had been designed to be planned. You couldn't simply privatize it, try to make it capitalist, when you didn't have the institutions of capitalism or the mechanisms that make capitalism work and that in the rest of the capitalist world had been developed over centuries. This simply did not exist. And what you had instead was the old Soviet era elite ruling in very much the same fashion as it had done before, extremely corrupt, arbitrary, power concentrated in very few hands. And when you combine that with a lack of effective capitalist institutions, that was a recipe for disaster. Now, You can make certain comparisons here. One of them is with Belarus on Ukraine's northern border, where the strategy followed was quite different. You didn't have precipitate privatizations. What you had instead was maintaining state control over the main industries at the same time as privatization was introduced lower down. That worked reasonably well. In Ukraine, you had the opposite. You had a highly ideological approach to the whole question. We're going to be as capitalist as we can, as rapidly as we can. And the result was that in the course of the 1990s, Ukraine lost about 60% of its gross domestic product. The size of the economy was more than halved. There's no parallel for this anywhere in the peacetime world, as far as I can work out, for a country to undergo a depression as severe and as prolonged as this. In Russia, things were pretty bad. You lost nearly 50% of gross domestic product there in the course of the 1990s. In Ukraine, they were worst. This is one of the worst advertisements for capitalism anywhere in the world. Capitalism in Ukraine in the 1990s was a disaster. And things haven't got fundamentally better since. So that's the general context in which the last couple of decades of Ukrainian history have been worked out. Extreme poverty, recurrent depression, political crisis.
Yeah. Well, that gets into, I guess, the kind of next kind of question, because I think you've given kind of like a very good kind of summary, a good kind of a context for, you know, Ukraine and capitalism. And I guess one of the things I guess we want to kind of move into, and I guess is towards the end of 2013, this is probably has the most significance in terms of contextualizing today's events today. But the end of 2013 saw the development of the Maidan Uprising, which was sparked by the Ukrainian government's sudden decision to not sign the European Union-Ukraine Association Agreement, and of course instead choosing closer ties to Russia and the Eurasian Economic Union. And I guess, what can you tell us about this movement? And I guess, what was the implications that it created for Ukraine, especially in terms of its relationship to the world kind of capitalist system, which obviously has a lot of significance?
Well, the Ukraine didn't arise off a bare table. It was a reflection of the dysfunction of the Ukrainian state under the economic system, and the severe poverty of the bulk of the population. And, of course, it had international ramifications as well. Ukraine remained closely integrated with Russia economically. This had all been a single economic expanse earlier. And the border in Soviet times had simply been something administrative, and firms on either side of that border interchanged products freely. You put that border there, you introduced customs boundaries and so on, the whole thing became much more difficult. And we also have to understand the structure of Ukraine's economy and of ownership. That process of privatization didn't unravel to the, or it didn't proceed to the advantage of the bulk of the population. Assets were seized pretty much by those who already controlled them. The directors of Soviet-era factories became their new owners under privatization. You had the rise of what's been described as an oligarchy, that is, rule by a few, rule by the people who had control of industrial resources, who formed into various regional blocs particularly. And the whole temper of Ukrainian politics consisted of this contest between various oligarchic blocs centered in various cities and regions and industries, none of them able to gain a decisive leg up over others. And so the whole political situation very unstable. One of the ironies is that those years before the Maidan uprising of early 2014 were some of the more prosperous ones since the end of the Soviet Union. There'd been a significant recovery, though the place was still much poorer than it had been in Soviet times. But nevertheless, there was a general sense of malaise and popular indignation at the extraordinary level of corruption within society and at the inequality, because you had people who were outright billionaires at the same time as the bulk of the population were not even getting by. Now, as I said, a great deal of disunity among that ruling elite and discontent with on the part of particular oligarchs with the rule from 2010 of Viktor Yanukovych, who was one of the most corrupt of all the oligarchs, and a sense that Yanukovych was using his power to aggregate a great deal of power and privilege of wealth in his hands and those of his family and hangers-on. Now, Yanukovych was from the east, from the industrial region of Donetsk. And one of the peculiarities of the Russian east was that its economic ties to Russia were particularly close. But at the same time, the traditional view of Yanukovych, pro-Russian, is not strictly correct. All Ukrainian oligarchs were more or less pro-Russian in the sense that they traded extensively with Russia. Many of them, not just Yanukovych, but also Poroshenko, his successor, had substantial financial interests in Russia. So you have this complex in which Russian ties are an element, the oligarchic nature of Ukrainian society was a very important issue as well. And finally, there's the issue of Ukrainian nationalism. Now, there was a long-standing tradition, particularly in the west of the country, that the source of Ukraine's problems was the presence of Russians, the so-called oppression by Russians, the persistence of pro-Russian ties and traditions. It cuts both ways because Ukraine's prosperity, such as it was, depended very much on trading relations with Russia and good political relations with Russia. But you had this strain of Ukrainian nationalism that was vehemently anti-Russian. And the indignation against Yanukovych, who was associated with the Russian speakers and had these ties to Russia, the impact of this was that Ukrainian nationalism began to line up against Yanukovych very strongly. And by the time that you had oligarchs who were antagonistic to Yanukovych, fearful of his designs on the economy, sensing that he was getting too big for his boots and seizing too much of the loot, you had this combination of oligarchic factors, of Ukrainian, right-wing Ukrainian nationalism, anti-Russian Ukrainian nationalism, coming to bear on the situation. Now, at the same time, the population as a whole weren't particularly antagonistic to Russia at all. There was the question of entry to the European Union, of closer ties to Europe. Yanukovych was on side with that. He was actively involved in negotiating an association agreement with the European Union that was intended to cut tariff barriers and expedite trade with the West. But at the same time, the economic situation was starting to get threatening. Debts were mounting, and Yanukovych understood that he was in trouble. He was applying for International Monetary Fund loans, the IMF and Western powers proposed a deal under which Ukraine would receive $17 billion in new credits, but this would be accompanied by extremely stringent austerity measures that would involve, for example, cuts to the wages of public servants, a freeze on the miserable minimum wage, and also as much as a tripling of the prices of gas. And natural gas, which came mainly from Russia, was a very important commodity in Ukraine. It fired up the furnaces. It warmed the population in the severe winters. And if you tripled the population, the price of gas in Ukraine, then any government would have been in very serious trouble. Yanukovych understood this. And while he was generally amenable to closer ties with the West, he balked at this deal, which would have driven him out of office and would have made him extremely unpopular. At the same time, Putin in Russia, wanting to keep Ukraine friendly to Russia, wanting to maintain those relations, wary of closer ties between Ukraine and the West, particularly as regarded NATO, the Western Military Alliance, decided to come back at this with a counteroffer that involved $15 billion in Russian credits and also a one-third discount on gas prices paid by Ukraine. This would have saved Yanukovych's bacon pretty much. But at the same time, it represented closer ties or a maintenance of already existing close ties with Russia. And Ukrainian nationalists, by and large, were extremely hostile to it. Also, by this stage, other powerful oligarchs had decided to throw in their lot with the West against Yanukovych. So you had this combination of Russian nationalists, of Ukrainian nationalists, plus various powerful oligarchs working on public opinion. Now, when I say working on public opinion, it was mainly the middle layers of the population in Ukraine. This wasn't a working class thing at all. It wasn't a broadly popular one. The working class in Ukraine were absolutely cynical about populations, about politicians of all stripes. They weren't going to support Yanukovych. They weren't going to support his opponents. The president was a rogue and a thief, but how would any of the others be any better? Nevertheless, that's the background to the Maidan revolution in early 2014 in Ukraine. As we know, this ended with Yanukovych being thrown out, and this right-wing nationalist pro-European strain in Ukraine and the oligarchs who are associated with it coming to power.
Mm. Following from that, can you tell us about some of the tensions that developed between the Russian government and Ukraine following the ouster of Yanukovych, and how do you think they inform what's going on today with the whole issue with the Russian invasion and such?
Well, the critical thing for Russia wasn't so much the European Union. They were used to dealing with the European Union, and they weren't especially hostile to Ukraine having closer ties. Even eventual European Union membership. That's something that the Russians could have borne. The critical thing was military. It was NATO. Now, NATO is a military alliance, and we have to remember that over the past 30-odd years, the Russians had had much reason to expect that NATO was strongly hostile to Russia and had definite expansionist ambitions. At the end of the Soviet period, the US had given Gorbachev what appeared to be an ironclad guarantee, at least verbally, that NATO would not expand to the east if the wall came down, if Germany became reunited. That undertaking was breached as early as 1994, 1997, with the accession of Poland and several other countries to NATO. The Russians gritted their teeth and they didn't like it, but the process was continuing. In the next century, it came to involve countries like Bulgaria, Romania, even the Baltic states. That meant that NATO was now only a couple of hundred kilometers from St. Petersburg, Russia's second greatest city. And why wouldn't NATO want to expand further? Now, another reason why the Russians were discontented with the association agreement that Ukraine was proposing to sign with the European Union was that it involved a military and strategic component. There was the understanding that NATO's security ties with Ukraine would be enhanced. So the Russians, extremely suspicious there, very conscious that Ukraine abutted right on the central regions of European Russia. It was like a knife in their belly. If that went with NATO, then their whole defensive capability, which was predicated on having buffer states between them and Western forces, would have fallen apart. And it's a fact that in many ways, Ukraine, after the Maidan, became a de facto member of NATO in all respects, except the undertaking that NATO members had, that if they were attacked, all of NATO would come to their defense. It's a fact, for example, that NATO powers took part in extended, large-scale military maneuvers on Ukrainian territory. You can't get much of a greater threat to central Russia and to Russian security in general than that. So the Russians were extremely unhappy with those developments. So that's the basis. The Russians absolutely intent on stopping Ukraine from joining NATO, exerting all kinds of pressures and veiled or not even veiled anymore threats against Ukraine. That's at the same time as trade between Ukraine and Russia declined heavily. Russia remained throughout most of this period Ukraine's largest single trading partner, but it was nowhere near as pronounced as it was. And that's another point on the economy, that the consequences of cutting off those trade and those commercial ties with Russia were extremely deleterious for Ukraine. And Ukraine, after the Maidan, in fact, went into severe and acute economic depression that lasted throughout 2014 and 2015. So the Maidan, closer association with Europe, didn't redound to the advantage economically of the Ukrainians. It had the opposite effect of thrusting them still further into depression.
And so Renfrew, it's around 7:54, and so we're running a bit low on time, so we're probably not going to be able to go into some of the other questions we were kind of interested in asking, but we do have some time for some final kind of comments covering, you know, some of the different things that I guess you've been saying, because I think you have given a very kind of good kind of history, you know, covering from, you know, the formation of Ukraine as a country following the dissolution of the Soviet Union, but then going into the kind of implications of the 2014 Maidan Maidan uprising, and I think it is that is a kind of important kind of history, because I guess one of the things about the mainstream kind of media, the corporate kind of, the capitalist sort of media's sort of take on these events is they're essentially wanting to selectively ignore all this kind of history, almost sort of like acting like there's no explanation for why Russia is invading Ukraine. Though, on the other hand, that said, I don't think we want to use this kind of context to basically say that, you know, this is a justification for the invasion, but it is, it provides a certain context that is obviously not afforded to, when it's a country that is opposed to the West, gets any sort of balanced kind of reporting. So yeah, I guess, yeah, if you, maybe to kind of conclude, like for the next, like if you kind of had some final comments to sort of, and maybe potentially we might have you on our program again to discuss some of the other sort of more contemporary events, including some of the significance of, Volodymyr's, Zelensky's electoral win in 2019. And I guess, you know, maybe addressing some of the myths around Ukraine, but yeah. Obviously, any sort of final comments in relation to sort of what you've sort of been speaking about for this interview?
Well, Ukraine has been presented in the last few weeks as some kind of paragon of liberal democracy. It's not. It remains very much under the thumb of its super rich. The political system, oligarchic parties based on particular aggregations of wealth, the population as a whole, utterly cynical. Politicians of every stripe profoundly discredited and mistrusted. The current president, Zelensky, was an actor who managed to talk his way into power on the basis that he wasn't a politician, he didn't have those old links, he hadn't been ingrained into the system of corruption. But on the other hand, he was worth tens of millions of dollars, and he did have a close working relationship with one of the very worst of the oligarchs. In power, he made no essential move to attack the oligarchic political system, and he very quickly lost popularity in recent times. His approval had slipped to just 24%. So let's not pretend that Ukraine is some sort of capitalist democracy. It's not. It's a typical capitalist oligarchy ruled by the super rich, in which the working people, the overwhelming majority, get an extremely raw deal. And it remains the poorest country in Europe.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Renfrey, for being on our program. This has, yeah, been a very useful and an important discussion, especially as, you know, especially as many are following the events in Ukraine kind of right now. So, yeah, thank you very much, Renfrey. And, I think you've given us a very kind of insightful history on all this.
It's been a pleasure.
See ya. Hope to have you back soon.